want to thank the Disease Council for asking me to speak today. Actually, I ran into Terry back in August at the annual APS meeting, and we were passing in a hallway, and she said, "Hey, we're having a symposium on thymatotricum. Are you interested, or could you maybe give a talk?" And you know, when you have a weak moment and you think, "Oh, I did my PhD subject on that, and that was a lot of fun. Sure, I can do that." Well, what I didn't realize was how much I had forgotten since I did a PhD. But over the last week or so, I've done a lot of digging around. I read my dissertation again. I was pretty impressed with what I did back then, but but I am certainly not any longer an authority on thymatotricum other than from that past experience. And so today what I'm going to try to do is give you an overview of just some historical information. And Terry is correct. Thymatotricum is now known as Thymatotriopsis omnivorum. And we all know it as, I was finally referred to it as PO, so I may do that while I'm talking because it's just some initials that I use for the organism. But you probably, I also may switch back and forth from Thymatotriopsis omnivorum to Thymatotricum omnivorum because that's what it was known for so many years. But finally, it's Thymatotricum root rot, Texas root rot, cotton root rot, the disease you don't really want in your field to be known as, you know, to be there. So anything you want to call it is fine with me. The other thing that really shocked me was when I read my dissertation, it started off by saying a little over 100 years ago. Well, now I'm standing up here saying a little over 120 years ago. So obviously I've aged, maybe not quite as fast as the fungus, but I guess probably equally. But it doesn't seem like it could have been 20 years ago that I started working with thymatotricum, but it is. So this disease was discovered in 1888 when Dr. Gully, director of the Texas Agriculture Experiment or Extension Service, commissioned someone from Missouri to come to Texas. He was a graduate student in Missouri to discover a rootworm that he believed to be the culprit of this disease in the field. When Dr. Gully, who wasn't a doctor at that point, but I mean, when Dr. Pamel got done, he had dispelled that the disease was not due to an insect. You know, the entomologists always think that they're the most important thing, so that's what they jump to first. But actually had found mycelial strands on the surface of the roots that he found. If you go back, and you can actually still pull these off the Texas A&M website, you can find two bulletins that he wrote in 1888 and 1889 that talk about his research and his findings. And it was unbelievable what that, even back then, what they knew and how little we've really discovered since that time. It's really amazing if you read those. And the other thing I find is an interesting tidbit. He's actually used this at the University of Wisconsin for his master's degree. No root rot in the whole state, but he used it to support his master's work in Wisconsin. What he really did was send some cultures of this fungus or samples to Harvard. And at Harvard is where they actually identified the fungus and classified it as Ozonium auricum. In 1907, it was renamed as Ozonium omnivorum. And this is when they compared it to a type culture of auricum. And here you can just see a picture of its characteristic hyphae and the characteristic cruciform branching that you see there. In 1916, Duggar actually discovered the conidial stage of the life cycle, which are the spore mats that sometimes in cotton you may never ever see, but a lot of times in the alfalfa fields and stuff you will see. And the fungus was renamed Thymatotricum omnivorum. Also in 1916, Texas A&M actually hired J.J. Taubenhaus to join the faculty, and his mission was to study Thymatotricum omnivorum. And anybody that works for Texas A&M will tell you, as a graduate student there, you're always told to stay away from this disease and to work on it. But obviously, as a young person, he decided that it was a good job, and he went after it. So the taxonomy of the fungus is fairly simple. It hasn't changed. It's a Deuteromycetina. It's in the orders Monilaceae and the family Monilaceae. What is really interesting is that the genus Thymatotricum was discovered or established in 1851. But I always enjoyed the interpretation of the name. The name, it comes from Greek origin. Thyma means tumor or swelling. If you've ever seen the sclerotia of the fungus attached to the mycelium, the sclerotia, which is the overwintering, is that swelling of that mycelium, and then trichum hair, so that swelling of the hair. So it's very descriptive of the fungus. And then omnivorum means all devouring. And you'll hear many times today, I'm sure, or this morning, that this fungus has a host of over 2,000 plants. So obviously it's an all devouring fungus. In 1973, Phymatotrichum omnivorum was studied by Hennebert and renamed into a new genus, Phymatotrichopsis omnivorum. Some of this was based on that there is no really known teleomorphic stage or sexual stage of the fungus. And I'll be honest, back when they did it and I did the exploring, I would probably have not renamed it that. He did all his work based on a herbarium culture, and that was part of the basis of his work. But some of the work since then and some of the genetic variability, it probably is rightly named Phymatotrichopsis now. The geographic distribution is basically the southwestern United States and Mexico. And I don't think we have a pointer, but where you see the black colors on this slide, well, that's all right. Where y'all see the black color on this slide is basically the limited area that Phymatotrichum is found in the United States and northern Mexico. Again, you can see that in Texas it was discovered in 1888. Quickly after that, Arizona found it 10 years later in 1898, followed by the Mexico states in Mexico in 1922, and then so far to New Mexico, Southern California, Arkansas, Southern Utah, Nevada, Oklahoma, and Louisiana. So you can see that it does have a fairly limited range for a geographic distribution. However, where it is, it's truly not a good thing to have it in your fields, especially at this point in time for control measures. In 1923, Talvin House identified the survival stage of the fungus, but described it as an obligate parasite. At that point, he felt like it only survived in the fields as surviving mycelium on plant tissue. He did not feel it could be surviving any other way. The vegetative stage of the P. omnivorum produces two types of hyphae. It's very characteristic. If you see, this is a slide from Dr. Krauss. It's actually a soybean, but it's one of the most where it shows you how thick the larger hyphae is when you see it on the surface of a root. You can actually peel it away from there and it still stay intact. The large cell hyphae have right angle branching, very similar to what you would see if you looked at Rhizoctonia, and multinucleated cells with septa 60 to 120 micrometers apart, with pores and veronin bodies, which is unusual for this type of fungus. The smaller hyphae actually intertwine around the larger hyphae, and they branch in pairs, as we saw in the earlier slide, that gives you that cruciform branching. The mycelium starts out hyaline in color and eventually turns to dark brown. And if you happen to be in here and are an orchard grower and have Phymatotrichum, you can see that the mycelium sometimes is almost black from the age on some of the larger like trees and stuff like that when you dig one of those up. The strands actually serve as the infectious network as the fungus moves from one host to another host within your field. So these large strands actually move from one cotton plant to another cotton plant, or to one alfalfa plant to another alfalfa plant in the field. It also serves as a network to move nutrients from the host down to the overwintering propagules that we call sclerotia. 6 years later, it was discovered that the mycelial growth and sclerotia would develop in the absence of a host, so therefore it was not an obligate parasite. But so there was actually a life cycle that you could get away from without having a host present. And the sclerotia stage is the primary survival means and inoculum for the disease. If you, for those of you that have never seen a sclerotia, which I'm sure there's many because they're not sometimes easily found in nature because you have to dig up a lot of soil to see them, they actually look like a seed, or maybe similar to in size, anywhere from a sorghum seed to a canola seed, if you're familiar with those sizes. They're dark in color, they have a thick wall and a thick outer melanin rind, and that actually helps protect it from the environment. 37% of that sclerotia is glycogen, so it has a food source that allows it to stay around for a very long period of time. It can be variable in size, so if you're familiar with the Sclerotia, Sclerotia robsii or other fungi, sometimes they look like BBs. They're so perfectly round. But this particular fungus, the Sclerotia, are variable in size and shape, and they often take the shape of the airspace in the soil that they're in. And they serve, again, as a considerable carbon source for the mycelium as the Sclerotia germinates. The other stage of the fungus is the conidial stage. There's a picture here of a buff-colored spore mat. If you look at this, it actually looks like just a different type of dirt. It gets very dusty as it ages, and there's millions and millions of globose conidia that come from this. These mats are normally observed where you have more than adequate moisture or high humidity, as you would see in a forage field of alfalfa, where you have moisture and it's at the bottom. The real mystery to this stage of the fungus is that no one really understands the life cycle purpose. There's never been able to produce Sclerotia from any of these spores. Very seldom can you get them to germinate even, and you cannot produce disease symptoms. So while we know it is related and part of the life cycle of the fungus, there's still no one that I know of, until someone raises their hand today or tells me later, that they know what the purpose is in the cycle. The life cycle is very simple and powerful. I think that's why it is so important in such a devastating disease. Sometimes the most simple things are the worst things. Basically, you have a vegetative mycelium that grows through the soil until it comes in contact with a root of some type. That mycelium grows up the root surface, and right below the soil level, it will infect that whatever host it is. The mycelium then translocates nutrients from that plant that it's infected and stimulates Sclerotia production deep down in the soil. The Sclerotia then overwinters until favorable conditions cause it to germinate and start new mycelium to grow again. So that's how simple the life cycle is. Mycelium, Sclerotia, back and forth. No real mystery to that, but again, a very powerful disease cycle. The means of parasitism is that, first, everyone calls it an indiscriminate pathogen, and they do that because it has so many hosts. But the uniqueness of this disease is that it doesn't normally commence until a plant is in the flowering stage, or the reproductive stage of its life cycle. Then, as we mentioned earlier, the fungus invades right below the surface at the root, and that actual invasion can be through mechanical damage, mechanical force, or natural openings in that root surface. It then kills the periderm tissue. There is literature and evidence that there is an unknown toxin produced by the vegetative mycelium that is capable of weakening or killing cells that allow for this invasion. Once the cells are invaded, there is a very quick movement from the cortex, the endodermis, and the pericycle. The vascular system of the root is then invaded, blocking the flow of water and photosynthetase to the plant. Again, 2,000 hosts of dicotyledonous plants. Most taproot plants that are agronomic or horticulture are highly susceptible to the fungus. The first symptom is slight yellowing, but I will be honest, in a cotton field, you don't see that very often. I mean, you would have to be watching that cotton field very closely to see that slight yellowing. But what you do see is you begin to see wilting in the topmost leaves. That's within 48 hours of the fungus invading the root surface. Wilting will occur then within another day of the lower leaves. This is very difficult sometimes, because when you think that it's attacking a cotton field at flowering, that's most of the time when it's already hot and dry, and so your plants are wilted somewhere during the day anyway because of moisture depletion. However, I will guarantee you, if you can determine that a plant has phymatoxic from root rot, you can walk out in your field and you can touch the foliage of that plant, hold it in your hand, and the plants that are infected have basically a temperature. Just like if you have a sick child at home and you touch his forehead to find out if he has a fever. Those plants, a wilted plant that doesn't have phymatoxicum is still cool to the touch. A wilted plant that is infected has basically the leaves, the foliage, are hot in your hands. So it's really a unique diagnostic tool to be able to do, and it does not take anyone with any experience. It's that clear. Death occurs so quickly that when you see a field that has died from Phymotoxicum, the leaves are still remaining on the plant. They're brown and dead for sure. And no matter what the host is, if you actually dig up the diseased plant, peel away the paraderm and look at it, there will be a reddish brown to almost maroonish lesion at that point. That doesn't matter which host it is. It can be as big as a pecan tree or a small ornamental in your garden. It will still have that type of lesion. And these are some of the characteristic lesions on some cotton plants. There are numerous reports that monocotyledonous plants are resistant to Phymotoxicum. Based on many researchers' studies, that is truly not an accurate statement. Monocotyledonous plants are more resistant, basically due to the architect of their root system. Having the fibrous root system, they have more root to sustain themselves if part of that root is invaded. So work that I did on my PhD certainly shows you that rotations with sorghum, corn, will certainly sustain the pathogen in your field. It may not kill your sorghum or corn plants, but they do serve as a host for the vegetative mycelium to get enough nutrients to reproduce sclerotia for the coming year. So crop rotations would have to be a fairly large window, and what I've read in the literature is anywhere from 4 to 6 years if you're going to use monocots as a rotation for reduction of disease. The fungus, we saw the graph, we saw the map, has a fairly small geographic region that it's home to. Most of those soils are calcareous, known as monomorolinic clay soil, or in Texas as Houston black clay. They're normally alkaline with a pH of around 8.0. And if you've done work in acidic soils, the fungus will not produce sclerotia. Also, if you've ever been in a field with these type of clay soils, you will know that they have a capacity to expand and shrink depending on the moisture content. You can see cracks sometimes that you think you'll twist your ankles in as you walk through a field of these type of soils. And then when they're moist, those cracks go away. In fact, I've been in some moist fields when I was doing some research and actually lost shoes in some of the soil when it was wet because it's so gummy and it goes around kind of like quicksand. However, this type of soil, because it has that ability to expand, it actually has poor gas exchange. Unfortunately, that's usually not very good for fungal diseases. Phymotoxicum actually likes that type of environment. And then moisture content is vital for fungal growth. I was downstairs, and Tom helped me understand this. Last year, if you go down and look at the disease charts downstairs for all the cotton diseases, it said 7% loss for Phymotoxicum this year, which is fairly high, which in Texas. But we had a really wet year, and so again, the moisture helped the disease do what it's supposed to do if you're a fungus. Mycelium growth and sclerotia production is usually in the 15 to 35 degree C range. It grows optimally around 28 C. And if you look at the map again, it's indigenous to regions where if you did an annual mean temperature of 16 C or higher. The one interesting thing is that the root rot belt is not uniformly infested. While there are millions and millions of acres that you would say are infested with Phymotoxicum, truly, if you look at the amount of soil infected within those areas, it's less than 1%. So if you're in a field and you have Phymotoxicum, in all likelihood, only if you look at the amount of disease in the soil, it's less than 1%. Although there's a lot of acres counted as infested. Again, one of the things we talked about with the gas exchange properties where P. omnivorum is tolerant of this poor gas exchange, it actually tolerates high concentrations of carbon dioxide. Sclerotia formation is actually correlated with the accumulation of carbon dioxide. And one of the interesting things of this fungus, which makes it very difficult for the control, the sclerotia being the means for it to overwinter from season to season, is that they've actually been found 8 feet deep. You try to do anything 8 feet deep in soil that's economically feasible, then you know you can't do it. But the majority are located in the first 20 to 60 centimeters below the soil level. Again, that's fairly deep for control measures. A three-year study showed at 30 to 60 degree centimeters below the soil surface, carbon dioxide was highest in June and July. Again, thinking about when this fungus attacks at the flowering stage, similar times. We always said by July 4th, you would see phymatopticum in your fields. Part of the water, you know, I always grew up in Texas, so you got new watermelons and you got phymatopticum by July 4th. That was one of the things you could count on. And so as you as the soil dries, expands, and closes, that carbon dioxide level goes up, therefore enhancing the life cycle of the fungus. The elevated CO2 environment, as mentioned earlier, gives this particular fungus a competitive advantage over many of the other microorganisms that you find as plant pathogens. The incident of root rot varies significantly from one year to the next is evident. Farmers will tell you that depending on the environmental conditions. What you will find first is you'll find a circular area of infestations in your field. So your whole field will not be infected, or you won't see necrotic areas over the whole field. In cotton field, the calculated rate of movement within a field is 5 to 30 feet per year. Again, that rate of movement is faster in alfalfa and slower in orchards. And you have to think about how far apart are our plants, because that mycelium has to move from one host to the other host to move the spread of the fungus. So depending on your crop, it depends on how fast it will move. The fungus moves both parallel and perpendicular to the row. It doesn't matter if it will move 30 inches to get to another cotton plant versus 6 inches to go down that row. It moves both directions. And one of the other things that's interesting, if you see there's a cutoff around Louisiana-Arkansas border. However, the discovery of the organism a little later in the discovery process, there's an explanation that the fungus can be spread by water and soil, and they believe that it moved into Louisiana by movement in the Red River from Texas and Arkansas. There are truly no true vectors, so there's no insects, birds, deer that actually move this fungus from one field to another. However, there's several instances in California, Arizona, all have quarantines on moving horticultural crops from a phymatopticum infected area into their states. For me, there are lots of horticultural crops grown in Mexico. California will not allow trees to come in from California any longer because of the risk of moving phymatopticum into areas in California that are still clean of the disease, especially in the vegetable growing areas that they have. What can be done? Well, that's a good question, and hopefully Tom is going to help us understand what can be done. This is a picture of the Blackland Experiment Station here in Temple, Texas, which was actually established to look at studying problems in Texas black waxy lands. And here's a quote. Root rot seems to be one evil that the cotton farmers in the Blacklands must learn to live with. The fungus has been found as deep as 8 feet in the ground. One field on the Temple Station in which there has been a heavy loss from root rot was laid fallow since 1928, with no crop planting of any kind. The land has been plowed at regular intervals to stimulate a cultivated state, but no treatment has been used on it. This year, which was 1940, for the first time since 1928, 4 rows of cotton were planted on the ground. Root rot has developed with the usual intensity in these 4 rows of cotton. Very good evidence that letting land lie idle will not get rid of this disease. That's 12 years there. So, okay. Control measures, well, there's been everything tried. Environmental manipulation, deep tillage. People have looked at trying to till soil to very deep levels. That's 30 to 45. But when you can find sclerotia at 60 centimeters below, that's a very costly means to control. How many of you would like to dynamite your soil? Would you like to go out there? It might be fun if you're frustrated, but that's probably not a very economical means, and I'm not sure the government would allow you to do this any longer, but actually dynamiting the soil, subsoil, was looked at as a means to control phymatopticum. It did increase yields, but those yield differences wouldn't pay for the cost of the dynamite. Flooding, I don't know how many of you have means to be able to flood your land, but it does show you can reduce disease if you actually take your land and flood it like a rice field. However, in Texas, there was a field flooded for 120 days to 15 centimeters, and there was no reduction in disease. So again, it's a pretty variable and pretty difficult process. Root rot barriers, there were actually people that dug trenches around their infested area. Some of these trenches, they put galvanized sheet metal in, and some of them poured concrete in them. Obviously pretty difficult for a fungus to grow through those, but economically for some of these farmers that have cotton and alfalfa, probably not doable. Sodium. This is a picture you may have seen before. We remember that fungus is found in calcium soils. Well, if you replace that calcium with sodium, not easily done, the fungus cannot survive. So this helps explain why Houston black clay, the infection in a field is so variable. If you take a field and look at the sodium content, it ranges from 100 to 2,000 parts per million. Therefore, where you have the highest sodium levels is where you're probably not going to have phymatoxicum. You're going to have them in those low levels. So in a field, that probably accounts for most of the localized distribution. Not sure anybody has a salt shaker big enough to control it, but give it a try. Biological control, many years this has been tried. The fungus is a very poor competitor. That's why it goes back to its sclerotia stage and stays away from all the other fungi. So there are many microorganisms that will feed on the mycelium and the sclerotia fungi of phymatoxicum. The consistency of control with these means is not there for our growers. Using green manure again delays the onset of disease, and mainly that's due to the high microbial populations associated, because again, phymatoxicum will not be where other microorganisms are. It just goes to where there isn't anything else. Soil fumigation is probably the most efficacious way to control the disease, but it's very expensive when you think of the level of application depth that you have to get to. So being able to apply a fumigate in the black clay soils to where you need to be to control the disease is pretty much impossible unless you have means to apply it from a non-traditional manner. Soil fungicides are very effective in a greenhouse or in the laboratory. The real struggle is being able to apply those fungicides, the large amounts that are needed to control this fungus, since you don't really have any know where it is. Most of the time, these fungicides don't have the ability to move in the soil. And applying a fungicide at flowering in a cotton field or in some of these other types of fields are pretty difficult. But I will let you know there are numerous fungicides that are efficacious against the disease. It's just being able to figure out how to apply them and get them where they need to be that is the struggle. And Tom is going to tell us how we're going to do that, right, Tom? So my question is, what will the next 100 years bring? Well, not me standing up here for sure, you know, since 20 years went by so quickly. I also would like to thank, and I'm going to apologize to anybody that I've copyrighted pictures or texts from, because I know I have. When I started working on this about a week ago, I realized all of my old slides were actually slides, you know, those little things that you put in a slide projector. And so having pictures for a PowerPoint presentation was difficult. So I'd like to thank all of these universities that at one time or another I probably took something for this presentation. And I want to thank my PO mentor, which is Dr. Stuart Lida. Many of you that have worked with this fungus, growers are like, probably know Dr. Lida. What he taught me was working on this fungus helped me understand all the things are not easily done and helped me learn to perseverance and the importance of not giving up. The characteristic of this truly unique pathogen, and I hope that other people out here take on that, because it is a disease that someday I would like to see controlled. I'm not sure I will, but I hate for it to be the winner, and right now, I think it's won. So anyway, okay. Any questions? I'll be around when everyone else speaks, when it's over too, but anybody have any questions? Okay. There's a couple seats up here if anybody wants to squeeze in. Thank you very much.